When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, this is Rebecca Atkinson-Lord, and I am here at Camden People's Theatre with Brian Logan, the Artistic Director, and Amber Massey-Blumfield.
Blumfield.
who is the Executive Director.
That's right, yeah.
And we're here, as normal, talking about legacy for the Legacy Tapes. These are a series of conversations about how you might want to leave something lasting in the ephemeral medium of theatre, or maybe how you might not want to. So hi Amber and Brian.
Hello.
And we've just been chatting a little bit before, and I've sort of warned you that I'm going to say to you both that you both have slightly idiosyncratic paths into running a theatre. And I was just really curious about how you both got here. Because just for people listening, one of the reasons that I'm talking to Amber and Brian together is that I'm really interested in how they work quite symbiotically, and they manage a sense of kind of pragmatic financial future planning with artistic brilliance and an agenda for innovation. I think that's really exciting. So guys, how did you get here? Why are you doing this, and how did you come together? Quickly, in like three words.
It's appropriate that we've got idiosyncratic roots to do this, because it's an idiosyncratic place, isn't it? It would feel inappropriate if we had had conventional roots to running CPT. My background was that I have co-run an independent touring theatre company for about 15 years before I arrived here, no, 13 or 14, but I also had a parallel career, and still do, as an arts journalist. So people have asked me throughout my career, you know, when am I going to give up one in order to do the other? You know, here I still am doing both, but yeah, so I was an independent theatre maker, not a director. Usually artistic directors tend to be people who directed. I have done directing, but it was never my main thing. I was a deviser, performer, ran this company, did a bit of journalism, here I am.
And okay, so what was the trigger for you to go, I will run a building?
My partner Jenny. When I took over Camden People's Theatre, what the job advertised was not artistic director, it was director, which was, well, I spoke to Chris Good once off the record. Chris Good used to be artistic director of CBT.
I love that you're now putting off the record on the record.
I'm probably totally misrepresenting him, but he gave me the impression that the job ceased to be artistic director after his reign, because the board had thought he was paying too much attention to the art and not enough to all the other things you need to do when you run a theatre. But anyway, by the time I arrived, it was advertised as director, which includes all the things that Amber now does, which are far too complicated for someone like me. So I probably wouldn't have applied for that, but my partner, Jenny Payton, who at the time was working in a producing capacity at Fuel Theatre and also at the Wellcome Trust, she suggested that we go for it as a job share. So we would share that job, me 3 days, her two, with her being de facto exec director, although the role didn't exist, to me being de facto AD. So I think I had expressed interest, first of all. I think I felt in my career like I was ready for a new challenge. I had been drifting a little bit. But yeah, without her, I think I would have been a singularly unimpressive candidate. So in fact, we got the job as a job share. And by the time Jenny left, we had restructured the organisation so there was an ED and an AD role, albeit that they were still part-time roles. And since Amber's arrived, the ED has become a full-time role.
Okay. Right, you'll go.
Okay. So I went to drama school, and I did quite an experimental performance degree, so that was quite aligned with CPT's work. And in fact, one of my plays that I wrote when I was a student was on here, which is... sort of night. And in fact, one of your early plays was on here.
Yeah, the first thing that my company, Cartoon de Salvo, ever did was at CBT, was one of the first places we performed it. In the what I think was the original Sprint Festival in 1997.
So then after I graduated, I was attempting to be a playwright with a relatively modest amount of success, I'd say. And so I got into doing PR for the arts, working for Mobius, and working with a lot of companies that have passed through CPT's doors and in fact did some work for CPT, but also other places like Battersea Arts Centre and, you know, shows that were at the South Bank Centre and the National and, oh, basically absolutely everywhere at one point or another, lots of Edinburgh Fringe stuff. And then kind of thought that maybe I'd try doing sort of PR and comms in a more strategic way, so I went to work for a guy called Mark Bukowski, who's kind of like a mad brilliant PR guru, and was doing like a lot more kind of commercial entertainment communications, but very kind of strategic projects for like big brands like Universal Music Group and Ticketmaster and those sorts of people, and then realised I didn't really like that very much, and unfortunately I'm not very motivated by money. Wish I could be, it's so annoying, but it's not the thing that floats my boat. So then went to work at the Albany as head of communications, and I think just was very interested in the idea of kind of how things work strategically, and, you know, that idea of kind of long-term planning and how you build, yeah, a kind of an arch over kind of 5 years or 10 years about where you're going. So that kind of took me down the idea of becoming an executive director. So when this job came up, I was like, well, that's perfect for me. I know CPT so well and I love it, so it all worked out beautifully.
Excellent. And how have you, because I think it's kind of interesting when people work so closely together, because Rachel and I did that at Oval House. Like, how do you manage making strategic plans? Do you always agree, which I know can't be true?
I think we get on remarkably well.
Yeah,
the biggest argument
so.
We've ever had is about the piano in the foyer and whether we could get rid of it or not.
I mean, that's just
I won.
Yeah, I think it works pretty well. No, we definitely. And do we always agree? No, I think we've sometimes got different emphases, but I think the values seem to be the same.
Mm.
You know, and even the differences of emphases are usually fairly easy to sort out. By the time we end up at the end of an argument, it's usually quite easy to find common ground.
Mm, yeah.
So yeah, it feels to me like it dovetails quite well our sensibilities. And
do you have like sensible sit down adult conversations, or do you have like screaming, rowing matches, or do you have somewhere in between?
No, I don't think we've ever had a rowing match, actually. Do
no.
I'm like,
it's so much fun.
I know.
I don't do rows. I mean, I'm sure, I don't know whether you do, but if we did have a rowing match, I'd be curled in a ball in tears. I'm the least confrontational person in the world, so
okay.
I'd rather lose an argument than win it shouting.
I think we're both quite pragmatic about things, and we kind of like know which each other's territory is, really, and kind of, we have quite a useful relationship where we'll kind of have a conversation and maybe play devil's advocate a little bit with one another, but then like ultimately I know what's Brian's decision to make and he knows what's my decision to make. And but I mean, generally, I know that sounds like incredibly boring, but we do really get on well. It's probably loads of simmering resentment I'm totally unaware of, but like, you know, it's us two and Anna, our general manager, and I do think we have a pretty clear shared set of values about like what we want CPT to be and what we want it to do, and you know, we're all quite politically in tune and stuff, so yeah.
So that's a great place for me to go. Okay, so when you're thinking about what you want CPT to be, are you thinking just into like so just bringing in this idea of legacy that these podcasts are supposed to be about, what are your stresses? Because I think so much of the work at CPT has a real political edge, texture. Are you conscious of shaping a wider, are you conscious of shaping something outside this space, or is it just about shaping the artistic narrative here? Or to talk to me about that, like what are the ripples that CPT sends out for you?
I think I'm very conscious of us kind of like shaping, you know, shaping a kind of, or contributing to a broader landscape of kind of ideas and what people are thinking about. I mean, I genuinely feel quite strongly that Calm Down Dear has probably played a role in, you know, albeit a small one, but in kind of pushing feminism to the forefront of the agenda again. And, you know, it's been going for 4 years and it's really been part of that climate. And I think that, you know, it has had a powerful role to play. I'm also really, really conscious of the idea that I think we, you know, we are, I don't like to think of us as a sort of gateway where everyone kind of passes through and like goes on to bigger and better things, because there's plenty of artists that don't and stay, you know, stay working at CPT. But I do think because we're quite often the first place that, you know, artists might have their first experience, professional experience, or kind of put on shows for the first time, we do sort of have a bit of a kind of conduit or catalyst role in terms of what might be happening in the industry and more broadly in 5 years time, what the big ideas are, and also who the artists are that are making the work. And so I think that, you know, one of the really big passions I think we both share, and I mean particularly for me, it's, you know, thinking about the question of who the artists we work with are and who we give an opportunity to and how that might impact on the landscape in 5 or 10 years time. It's like, if we get it right, that has a consequence for who might be at the National, or, you know. But, you know, it has merit on its own terms as well. But is that fair?
Yeah, it's all fair, yeah. I mean, I think when we were bandying back and forth that early draft of the business plan, one of your drafts of the mission statement or the vision or whatever, I think I sent back because there had been a phrase in it that sort of implied that we were going to change the world or something. And I was like, oh, we should do that again. So I think I'm probably like just constitutionally like a bit less at ease about stating the wider political impact we can have.
That's my PR background coming through.
It's not that I don't want to believe it, it's just like, you know, I am also aware that we're a small fry in the great scheme of things. And I'm Scottish and don't want to overstate anything or blow my own trumpet or whatever. But yeah, I'm satisfied with everything Amber said is true about how we can, you know, start things here that go on to have bigger effects elsewhere. You know, and we can, you know, like agenda raising or you know, creating a focus around things that are already out there in the ether. You know, I think Cam Dowdy has done that, or, you know, like when No Milk for the Foxes was here, which was a show that a couple of working class theatre makers who had not made their own show together wanted to make a show about class representation in the theatre. You know, and before that run was finished, we got a feature in the arts pages of The Guardian about that show and about some research that some academics at LSE were doing about, you know, working class actors and so on. Mm-hmm. And we helped bring that together and get a feature in a national newspaper about that. So, which is, you know, that's just one example among many about the way that our political sensibility can create, you know, can have a more of a high profile effect than you might expect for a relatively small theatre.
And also I think it is relevant that, you know, Brian has this other career as a journalist and my background is in PR, because I do think that probably gives us a particularly attuned sense of kind of, you know, what the kind of the zeitgeist topics are and how we can perhaps engage in conversation more widely than simply with our own arts community. So, I mean, that's a good example, but I mean, we're always kind of pushing topics that we think have a relevance to a broader audience than purely an arts audience, and that are, you know, particularly apposite in one way or another.
So how do you, because I think one of the things that I'm aware of when talking to artists is this sense that there's the art thing, and then there's like the political, there's like the need, there's the thing you need to say, and then the why you need to say it. And managing the balance of those things can be a tough one, because at the point at which you're like, I'm just going to shout at you about like feminism or or class or whatever, then the people listening are probably going to be like, well, I'm just going to not listen. What are the conversations you have with artists that kind of manage that? Or do you not? Do you let them judge it?
Well, one of the reasons when I started working at CBT, you know, it was a decision that Jenny and I actively made to go, okay, let's be more declaratory about the fact that Camden People's Theatre has a political agenda. That didn't used to be in the mission statement or whatever.
It feels like it's in the name, though.
It feels like it's in the name. It partly came from that, because when we arrived in our interview, in fact, or certainly after we arrived, the board said to us very explicitly, you can change the name. The perception was, and they didn't encourage us to change the name, but obviously there was a sense that the name was a problem, or the name was a, you know, and for a while, so we thought about that. Jenny, I'm sure she won't mind me saying, was well up for changing the name. And I thought, actually at the time we thought, well, the the wrong thing about the name is the word peoples, because it makes us sound like a trade union or the People's Front of Judea or whatever.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah, although actually, retrospectively, I realised that, and then I thought, maybe it's the word theatre that's the problem, because actually we do such a white, like, performing arts or whatever else. And then I now realise the problem word is Camden, because we're actually not in Camden Town. It should be used to the People's Theatre or whatever. Although we're very proud to be in Camden Borough. But yeah, we decided eventually, and Jenny was totally on board with this, that actually, rather than be apologetic about the word peoples in your name, let's make it mean something. So then we embarked on a whole sort of inquiry about what does it mean to have People's Theatre in your name, especially when you're associated with experimental work. And popular and experimental tend to be thought of as different things.
Yeah, that really pisses me off.
It pisses me off, yeah.
Tell me about it pissing you off.
Well, I think if people are alienated from the theatre, which is a whole different discussion, the thing they're alienated from is not experimental theatre. It's people swishing around in gowns opening French windows.
More French windows.
You know, but they're not, it's the thing that has alienated them from the theatre is unlikely to be the really exciting stuff that a whole bunch of amazing young artists are doing at CBT.
Yeah.
If they could see that, they might feel less alienated.
I think there's a really insidious narrative around, like, what is accessible, because if you assume that an ordinary person, a civilian, cannot engage with and access really quite complex experimental work, then what you're saying is that those people are stupid, and fuck you, frankly, if that's your assumption.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. So that's part of the agenda of exploring this word peoples and making CBT a bit more of a overtly political place. But one of the others is that I had, you know, as a journalist, I had written up about the phenomenon whereby, you know, independently made, devised theatre tended, I'll come at it this other way, political theatre tended to be seen as the work of, like, solo playwrights. Mm. Like Sir David Hare, he's our greatest political playwright, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
You know, political work seemed to be associated with individual playwrights espousing political philosophies, whereas the devised independent sector was more associated with intimate personal concerns.
Mm.
And was seen, this is all out of date now, it's no longer the case. But, you know, I'd written articles on that phenomenon, and my observation arriving in this post was that there was a whole generation of people making work who were politicised, and obviously the world was becoming more politicised, but they would benefit from encouragement to bring that out of their work a bit, because there was a real stigma to the whole idea of being didactic.
Mm-hmm.
And I still think that's the case among the younger generation of theatre makers. There's no greater sin than being didactic, telling people what to think. You know, which is fine, no one wants to be told what to think, but I often go to theatre and think, I've enjoyed that, but I wish you'd told me what you think.
What's your central thesis?
Yeah, and sometimes people are so terrified of telling other people what to think that they don't even say what they themselves think.
Mm.
So anyway, I felt that it would not be a bad job to do to encourage people to if they had political instincts when they were making a piece of work, to be more overt about them. I forget what your question was, but I'm sure that's a brilliant answer.
It was a brilliant answer. Yeah, it was about how you manage artistry and political agendas.
Mm.
And that was an answer.
We've tended to encourage people to not be afraid of being didactic. You can always pull it back, but don't be afraid to walk towards it in the first place.
Within that, if, like, there are lots of things that we're touching on that are kind of around ideas of what people refer to as risk, like shit that might bomb, or that people might not like, or that might, I don't know, I don't really know what risk means, but other than people not paying to see it, which I don't really care about. So my question is, it feels like a lot of the work that you support is quite risky, in whatever that Arts Council board definition is. How do you manage that risk versus a sense of stability for the organisation, or a sense of kind of something that a fixed point that the organisation can move towards? Or maybe, well, talk to me about that. You might want to reject the premise of the question.
Mm-hmm.
Feel free.
I think it's something about, for me, it's about accepting that that's what CPT exists to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of our raison d'etre, to be a place, you know, for kind of like risky work, and where artists can come and put stuff on that, you know, really might not find a home elsewhere. And I think as soon as we start to think about our business plan moving to a place where that's not possible, that's not us doing what we exist to do anymore. So we might have conversations, for example, like, would we wish at some point to be in a much bigger venue, for example, or a better venue? You know, but then that conversation always comes back to the question of, well, is there a risk if we're suddenly in a venue with 250 seats that our programming concerns are going to be entirely different? Mm-hmm. And therefore the answer to that question is likely to be no, we wouldn't move into a bigger space because we wouldn't be able to program the same kind of work. So for me, it's the principle of, you know, particularly from the point of view of being an executive director, your job is to understand what position the organisation holds within the whole ecology, mm-hmm. and do that really bloody well. Mm-hmm. And right now, I think for CPT, that means, you know, enabling people to take risk. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was right. We're in a quite a lucky position to be able to take a punt on stuff without thinking that we're going to lose our shirts because it's a wee place and because we're used to doing so. Yeah, I mean, I seldom conceptualise things in terms of risk at CBT. I suppose we have, the more successful we become, the more...
You can totally tell me to fuck off with my false binary.
No, it's not a false binary, it's just, I suppose you just... Yeah... I don't know, what's risky in the context of CPT?
Yeah.
You know, what might be perceived as risk elsewhere to us is just not normal. I mean, occasionally...
Our reality.
Yeah, which isn't me going, oh my God, look at us daredevil tightrope walkers. It just doesn't particularly feel like that because we don't have that high a height from which to fall if something goes wrong because we're pretty skin-tailed.
That was one of the things when I left Oval House that kind of bamboozled me, because there were things that I'd been working on that everyone at Oval House had been like, oh God, this is so trad, and had really kind of sneered at me for. And I tried to take out into the world and they were like, oh God, it's so risky. We can't. I'm like, are you kidding me? This is like the boring thing no one has let me do for 4 years.
Mm. I mean, I suppose in terms of commercial risk, we, you know, you're really keen on us doing 3-week runs. Which I agree with. It's good for our programme if over the course of a year, you know, because a lot of work comes here for 1, 2, or 3 nights. Mm. It's good if we can find several shows a year that can do good runs. But it's good for CPT, it's good for the artists if we can help them to do that. But that's sometimes a more risky proposition for us, given the type of work we work with. Are we confident we can find an audience for such and such a show over a substantial run? So to that degree, there is such a thing as commercial risk. But sometimes there are risks associated with some of the more far out material we stage, but
I love it though. I love it those nights when it's just something we've programmed and it's just so completely bonkers and far out, and you're just in the theatre and you just think, oh, I just don't feel like there's many other places in London this could happen, and I just love that, and I think that's exactly what we exist to do. And it's like, they, you know, the more like far out and like crazy it is, I just think the better, basically. But
that's what people come for.
I think we've done a lot in terms of like building an audience for what we do and people understanding what we do and us kind of like not being afraid to be what we are. So for like example, our season brochure, this season brochure we decided to put on the front: this autumn CPT will smash the patriarchy, solve the housing crisis, fix Europe, put the kids in charge, and send you home with a song in your heart. Mm. I mean, I think it's quite a bold statement about kind of what kind of theatre we want to be. I mean, it's a bit tongue-in-cheek, clearly. Although
yeah,
I hope we do.
I really love that on the Calm Down Day poster it says, smashing the patriarchy in 3 weeks flat or your money back.
Yeah.
Just kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's something that kind of amuses me about that.
Yeah, totally. And I think we've probably gone quite a long way in communicating more about kind of like the boldness of what we're about and the kind of politics of what we're about and where we're coming from. And I think, you know, it's working. I mean, our box office like doubled last year without us increasing the ticket prices, because we are like getting a lot more people in, and I think we're just articulating what we're about more clearly and just being, yeah, kind of more specific about what we are rather than kind of trying to be all things to all people.
Mm.
But then of course you're like balancing with the fact that we really want to kind of like build our local audiences, and this thing about like the question of where populism sits in relation to experimental work, but that's kind of an ongoing interesting point of inquiry, I think. So
I just wasn't sure if you wanted to say something.
I'm sitting here thinking about, I'm just cogitating now on the word risk and its various meanings in the context of CBT and its work. I'm wondering whether there's anything to say about the various conversations we have about like box office splits and financial deals with artists and stuff like that, which is a conversation we have a lot of because we want to get it right, and we're very aware of the whole conversation around artists getting paid. You know, and the degree to which how do you divide up the degree to which you want to share? You know, the artists have to take some of the financial risk as well as the venue, and I'm not sure. I'm only throwing that in because it's another conversation in which the word risk crops up.
Yeah, and I think that conversation is such a tricky one because a small venue for like CBT with limited box office income and like limited kind of subsidy, like there is only so much risk that you can take in a sustained way, and that organisation kind of can't exist in the same narrative as somewhere like, you know, as a big regional flagship studio who actually often will work on a similar financial deal.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's in that conversation around risk, because artists bearing the risk, you know, £50 risk for an artist is a much bigger percentage than a £50 risk for an NPO of any size. But again, like the relative risk is so different between an artist and then somewhere like CPT and somewhere like, I don't know, Birmingham Rep or the Royal Exchange or one of those big places. I find that conversation actually really tricksy because my instinct is always to be like, no, it's not fair to make the artist take the risk because that means they can't actually live anywhere if it goes wrong. But then at the same time, that conversation actually is also true here, because there'll come a point where you take too much risk and this place cannot exist.
Mm.
But then the amount of risk you can take is upscaled. So I feel like we don't talk about it in kind of a proportional way enough.
Yeah, I mean we're talking about this a lot at the moment, and we definitely haven't alighted on a solution yet. I think, you know, I think the other big thing as well is like how do we rebalance things without avoiding the impulse to become much more commercially minded about things, because if we're paying a lot more in terms of fees or we're getting, you know, a much smaller split, then we need to know that we're going to make more money out of it. And then automatically your psychology is, well, we're going to go for much more kind of like safe bet shows then. But I guess, yeah, we're kind of weighing all these things up at the moment and, you know, trying to figure out an answer of balancing all these things, but it is, you know, you're right, we're tiny.
Yeah, and as an artist also, I think there's also a thing that I sometimes want to say to artists is that you can't expect your art to exist outside a commercial mechanism and then expect to be paid in a way that reflects a commercial mechanism. And that's an unfortunate truth. We either buy into the capitalist market economy or we totally destroy it, but those, like, it's difficult for those things to exist at once. But then when I'm working as an artist, you know, when I'm an artist, when I haven't got a producer hat on, I'm like, no, I deserve to be paid. I want, you know, the means of production in my hands.
Totally. Yeah, we'd like that too. You know, but yeah, it's balancing all those things, and it's all those questions like, well, is it better for us to, you know, make more money to spend on commissions, and, you know, we have a whole, you know, big seed commissioning program for artists from BME backgrounds now. You know, is it better that we're kind of supporting that, or should we just be shifting the box office split, or should, you know, it's such a complex nuanced thing, and, you know, the decisions that you're weighing up, you're, you know, coming back to that thing about like what's the mission statement all the time and what are we trying to achieve, but it's all these like nuanced decisions along the way.
So when you're thinking about all of this stuff, because it feels like you guys are really wrangling with like what the ecology is and what you want it to be, and trying to send meaningful ripples out. It's like that visual. Where is your point of assessment? Like, what point do you measure whether you're achieving it? Like, is it in a year? Is it in 5 years? Is it a decade? Is it 100? Because I guess that is related to what it is which you're seeking to affect.
Well, I think my psychology is probably, I maybe think about things kind of like 5 or 10 years time, because I always have this vision in my mind of like what like the land, you know, the theatre landscape particularly might look like as a consequence of what we do in 5 or 10 years time. And we have like, so we're just writing our business plan for 2018 to 2022, which is a bit scary, and you know, actually, so we're still pursuing the same mission, but then over that time period we will have like a couple of key objectives for us to kind of focus on. So one thing is about going to be about the ethnic diversity mm-hmm. of emerging artists.
Mm-hmm.
Is it okay to say this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think the other thing, like really taking, you know, that 4 year period to understand what localism means to CPT, because we've always in the past had like an idea that we want to be much more engaged locally, but maybe it's been a little bit intangible about what that means. And like, you know, we're such a tiny organisation, who is our kind of local community? It doesn't mean being, you know, all things to everyone that happens to live in NW1 or whatever. So actually really giving ourselves permission during that business plan period to kind of almost experiment a little bit and, you know, try out different things and answer that question for ourselves organisationally, with a view to then the next period we might have a much more coherent strategy and go, well, we spent that 4 years trying out different things, like looking at it from different perspectives, and now we've discovered this, so this is what's going to happen over the next period.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's quite helpful, actually, you know, not feeling that we necessarily have to have all the answers straight away, but that we can engage with the process of kind of learning about it creatively and artistically and be intrigued by the process of finding the answers out rather than, you know, having to know it all straight away.
Yeah, because but I think especially in terms of diversity, like, no one knows any of the bloody answers. I mean, most of us don't even know what the right question is.
Yeah.
So that's a really nice place to start, is what, like, what even are we asking?
But also I think as well, this kind of like, particularly on the question of the ethnic diversity of the artists we're working with, I think we're being quite crude about it right now, like talking about like what percentage of the artists in our programme come from non-white backgrounds and things like that, and what should it be? That feels like horribly crude. I mean, that, you know, we shouldn't have to be talking in those terms at all. But again, I sort of have the feeling that, well, if we talk about it in this way, you know, over the next 3 or 4 years, then maybe we'll get to the point where we don't even need to have that conversation, because it will already, you know, it will kind of automatically be happening. And I'm really like pleased about the fact that it already feels like, because we've been pushing it, it's kind of starting to take on its own momentum, in the sense that a lot of artists would come to us now and think the CPT a place they might come and perform, who might not have come here before, you know, getting approached by theatre companies to partner on projects that are specifically about this issue, you know, who just wouldn't have thought of us as, you know, that's a question or a space that we want to be in
before.
Yeah,
they wouldn't have seen themselves in our space before.
Yeah, so it's, I think it's amazing how quickly it can make a really big difference. You just got to work at it, basically, and just crack on, haven't you?
Yeah. How about you, Brian? What's your time scale?
I don't have one. I'm the least future projecting person in the world, in my own life and professionally. It's pathetic, you know, people really have to force me through my own trauma to be strategically.
So tell me why you do stuff. Like you know, the show that you've programmed for this year, why, like, what was your intent? It would just be cool?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Okay. I mean, that's brilliant. Like, I wish that was possible.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's partly why I think we work well together, because, you know, and it was the same with Jenny in the past. Jenny had a strategic brain, but yeah, I just really
but hang on, because I just want to unpack that a little bit, because why is something brilliant because the experience of it in the 90 minutes when you're watching it is brilliant, or because you carry something with you out of the place for the next week is brilliant, or because in a year's time you might think back to it and go, oh, or because it might chain or it might affect, it might have some impact on the wider arts ecology. Like, your definition of brilliant
tells
me what the time scale
is.
It's
all of those things, but what it never is, at least in my imagination, is it's never because, oh, if we program this, then in 10 years' time the theatre landscape might look like that.
Okay.
It's never that for me.
Yeah.
But yeah, it can be anything between that. I've seen that show, it's absolutely magic. I'd love to have it here so other people can experience that too.
Mm.
You know, or it can be like doing our festival of housing crisis and regeneration, whose London is it anyway? You know, you just think, well, that, you know, there's a whole bunch of work bubbling up about that. So if we did a festival around that, that'd be a super exciting way to focus the conversation around that and to try and push that agenda forward and to connect with loads of communities that we're not currently speaking to. And so is that strategic thinking, or is that just thinking this would be a wicked thing to do?
I trick Brian into strategic thinking. He doesn't know that he's doing it, but by the kind of tone of the conversations that we have. Now, I think you are doing yourself a bit of a disservice, because I think
it's not meant to be for false modesty. It's generally, that's my sentiment.
But I think that there's a, you know, I don't know, a sensibility and a set of principles that are built into the decision making process that, you know, maybe don't necessarily feel that strategic at the time. But I mean, we often have conversations about shows that we really, really like, but they're just not right for CPT because, you know, they're not achieving what we want to, you know, what our programme is.
Yeah,
there
I
to
agree.
Do,
yeah, it
can
be strategic in that sense, I suppose, but it's the sort of future thinking that.
Yeah,
usually just quite literally brings me out in a cold sweat when people invite me to think about where I'll be in 5 years' time. Like, literally, I have to leave the room.
He's great fun on away days.
But I feel like that's really interesting, because I think we don't. I'm aware that we don't get to think immediately very much. Like, we always, like, with, you know, your business plan, and that's how you get your money. Of any kind,
mm-hmm.
and I think we're encouraged to think in quite an instrumental way about impact on society and ecology and whatever. But actually, there is a value in art in a really just fucking immediate sense, right? It just makes this moment better.
Yeah, I don't really believe in the future. It's a philosophical thing, isn't it? There's no such thing as the future. It's just a constant sequence of present moments in which I live. You know, you could spend a lot of time worrying about the future and then you get hit by a bus. Why bother?
I'm going to take that and I'm going to raise it to there's no such thing as now, because anything we're perceiving is actually the past, because by the time we've perceived it, it's gone.
Wow.
So, fuck it, we're all living in the past.
So let's rip up the business plan now.
So I feel like this is leading into, why do you guys do this? Like, why theatre? Why performance? Why the arts? Why? It's a terrible career choice. Everybody advised me against it. Like, why'd you do it?
I've never regretted it for a second.
It's not an answer though, is it?
Why does anyone do anything except you sort of fall into it? As I've just described, I've never projected forward, so I never had anything resembling like an ambition to do something when I was young. I think I probably ended up in this largely because my friend Alex Murdoch asked me to join her theatre company at the point at which I was graduating. So she's entirely to blame for my theatre career. Why do I now do it? I'm sure, like everyone who works in the arts, you've not infrequently asked yourself a bunch of questions about how valid is this, or what difference is it making, or is it just shoring up all the existing privileges, or are you just like a court jester to capitalism? But, you know, broadly speaking, I'm satisfied that, you know, the work I do in its own small way makes some people's lives better, or you know, encourages more good into the world than bad, which is, you know, maybe not all that ambitious, but not the
it's
worst
not
thing.
Right place to start.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I guess I think just always have felt sort of pretty at home working in theatre and performance. Like, you know, I've been heavily involved since I was probably about 10 years old, and never really had, apart from when I had a slight waver and tried to be commercial, and realised what a mistake it was. Actually, that was, you know, that was a really, really heartening thing to go away and try and work in a different context and really discover that it didn't make me happy at all. And actually, you know, that I really do feel very happy and sort of doing what I should be doing with my life. So that's really, really positive. Yeah, so just where I'm supposed to be, basically. It's a bit of a, feels like a bit of a no-brainer.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to, you've definitely, you know, as you have alluded to, you don't make much money out of it, so you've got to love it. I mean, I love it to bits. You know, I keep harping on about Jenny. When Jenny worked here, she, you know, she no longer works in the arts, and she did a good job at Camden People's Theatre, but she didn't enjoy it. You know, because it was the, she didn't really love the arts enough. She didn't love theatre enough, and she wouldn't mind me saying that. She would admit that. You know, the only way to survive some of the difficulties working in the arts is by loving the hell out of the arts or whichever art form you happen to be involved with. You know, and there's more than enough like thrills and excitements at being at CBT and watching young artists blossom or seeing amazing pieces of work by people with 20 years less theatre making experience than you, which are far more theatrically sophisticated and terrific than anything you've ever made. You know, it makes the heart soar frequently. It's like or telling stories to people that have a profound effect on them. You know, or being the people who created a space for that to happen is a super motivating and inspiring thing to do. So yeah, that's why I stay in it, because it's really good fun.
Yeah, and I think I do sort of have, you know, for better or worse, like some kind of like real faith in kind of like the particular power of what theatre can do, and that being something that is distinctive from what anything else can do almost. And I think it's something about the kind of idea of kind of a third space, and like, you know, I'm really interested in theatre buildings in particular and like what role they can play in society, and this kind of place where people can come together in, you know, a real time and a real place and engage with really, really big ideas and think really, really deeply about things is, yeah, that I really have faith that that's a really important thing to happen, and it's a pretty cool thing to do with your life to kind of try and facilitate that happening and trying to hold those spaces. You know, and I think theatre does it in a different way to any other kind of context that meeting happens, because the business is of thinking about what the significance is of meeting, if that makes sense. So I mean, there's obviously other parallels you could think, like, I don't know, like a church or a football stadium or something like that, but actually, because your job so much is thinking about what it means for all those people to be in that room together,
the reciprocity of it, in that there's a sense, like, for example, in church, that, you know, God does his thing regardless of whether I turn up to church, but this thing in the theatre, it's the meaning of it exists at the point it goes into my head, at the point that we together do this thing, and and something is made in the gap between us.
Yes.
So that reciprocity, you don't get that in church. You get told stuff.
Yeah.
Maybe you get it at a football. Maybe there's something in like massive sports. I don't understand sports. So I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But like I feel like there's a collective tribalism in sport, but there isn't necessarily that connection between doer and observer or audience and performer, or whatever those right words are.
Yeah, there's some kind of like something different about the kind of contract in theatre, isn't there? And it's, yeah, I mean, it just, like, I think quite often the fact, like, it just seems like it shouldn't work, like it's kind of illogical in a lot of ways, like it's probably a really bad business model that you, like, you know, spend so much time and energy creating this thing that's only ever going to be seen by a handful of people, you know, and yeah.
But also, because we're really social, like, I'm reading a book about the, like, human evolution at the moment and how our society's evolved, and I'm really interested in this sense that we're so social and we have these massive brains that allow us to be social, but our being social is what makes our brains massive. It's this weird feedback loop, and so we are who we are because we get together in groups and we imagine shit.
Yeah,
like that's literally what makes us human.
Yeah.
And we collaborate and we imagine, and those are the things that make us different.
from our nearest, you know, chimps and bonobos, that are our nearest relatives. So that in it, that like theatre feels like the purest form of that, because it isn't just, because there's the audience performer as an individual, but also if you don't have the other 50 people there with you, it's a totally different experience. It feels different. Like you need to be sitting in a group, even if you don't talk to them, even if you don't. There's something about breathing the same air.
Yeah.
That really matters.
And I love the idea that everyone just subscribes to sit there in the dark in silence together and accept that that's what they're going to do for 2 hours. You know, I'm not like really down on this idea.
Even though that seldom happens at CBC, for better or worse.
We're going to do this thing together and we're going to be safe. I'm safe with these other 50 strangers. I trust you guys not to do bad shit to me. In the semi-dark.
Again, fatal mistake.
I think as well, like, I have this like real optimism that like there's going to be, you know, because, you know, of the landscape and like how reliant we are on social media and all the rest of it, like I have this kind of faith that, like, you know, theatre is going to become more, even more attractive, more desirable and more necessary to people's lives as a kind of counterpoint to, you know, the kind of weird, isolating but allegedly social experience of kind of being online. It feels like it kind of chimes with, you know, the things that are kind of moving away from that. I don't know, something about mindfulness or like, you know, the need for that kind of collective life, sort of current connection. It feels like theatre will become more important
because it only works if you're here now.
Yeah. And like, isn't that bloody great? Like, isn't it like just going to be so, you know, aren't people going to feel so refreshed about the fact that they might have to like switch their phones off for 2 hours? Like, and that actually being like a really healing, cleansing sort of alternative offer to what, you know, so much of the rest of our lives are now. So,
yeah, there's something about being given permission to just be present,
and
focused, that you kind of don't, like, you get quite rarely.
Yes, sure, exactly.
I'm just in my head.
No, we know all these things, but there's still a lot of work to do to spread the gospel, shall we say. You know, like, I agree with you, theatre has the potential to become a lot more, a lot bigger and more popular and perceived in different ways, but then we're also living through a time when, like, theatre and education is disappearing, or, you know, lots and lots of young people are not exposed to it in the way that they used to be, so...
But I think it's interesting, I sort of think, like, you know, it's sort of part of that same thing where, you know, now there's, like, a big trend coming in for, like, people reading long-form essays, and they want to spend loads of time really engaging with a big idea, because it's such a counterpoint to so much of how quick and instantaneous our culture is. Mm. And I think theatre, you know, again, could be a really, really healthy and meaningful...
Yeah, no, I agree, but it's a small tranche of society who are reading
right now,
essays.
Brian. We'll keep preaching the gospel.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything you say, but I'm just as concerned as everybody is, and as we always have been, about making sure that it's not just an art form that entertains the well-to-do.
Yeah.
Except at Christmas. And everybody comes.
I think that well-to-do thing is another one of those really massive misconceptions about what theatre is that drives me a little bit insane. And then I say it's a misconception, and then my boyfriend took me to see a thing at the National the other day that I never would in a million years would have booked to see, but it was very kind of him, and and thank you, Julian. And I shouted at him all the way home because I was so angry about the thing.
Are you going to reveal what it was?
It was Platonov at the National. And I'm not its target audience. I was at least 20 years younger than the other youngest person there. And it made me really angry because it was all of the things that I spend all my time telling people theatre isn't, I think.
Mm.
There wasn't space for me or for anybody I fucking know in it.
Mm.
And it was perpetuating like shit about women that made me really angry, and shit about class that made me really angry, and it was a dead white play in a new version by fucking David Hare, who I'm sure is a lovely bloke. Hi, David. I'm sure you listen. I'm sure he's a lovely bloke. But like, I don't need to hear that story again. That story has so much space. That story needs to be killed. And I look. I'm doing it again. I'm shouting. I'm ranting. So theatre, because theatre is that thing, right? That thing that only the well-to-do, that kind of theatre is. How do we spread the gospel? How do we make it different?
Mm.
Because also, you know, I've seen some things at the National that felt like the most... Like, I saw Walworth Farce, Enda Walsh's Walworth Farce, directed by Michael Murphy at the National. Like, one of the most alive and brilliant and transformative things that I will ever see, and I carry it with me, and I wonder about it regularly on the bus still, like 5 or 6 years later, 7 years later.
Well, we had a conversation last night in our feminism festival. We had a on stage panel discussion about women, politics and power, and Ayesha Hazarika, who's a political commentator and former advisor to the Labour Party, she was talking about how to reform politics to make it more diverse.
Mm.
And she said somewhat counterintuitively that she thought the single thing that would be most effective would be to diversify political commentary, which is all done at the moment by middle-aged white men.
Mm.
With the exception of Polly Toynbee and a few others. But, you know, I'm sure to some degree you could say the same about theatre. You know, and the cadre of theatre critics has evolved a little bit over the past few years, but you wouldn't look at the theatre critics and the National Press and say that they're the most diverse bunch in the history of the world.
That like really used to drive me a bit crazy at the Albany, actually, like the extent to which I felt that like there was so little acknowledgement that like a perception of quality by kind of the mainstream press was entirely shaped by like what
the default man would like.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact is that things like Platonoff, you know, there's, I mean, don't mean to single out Michael Billington, but I'm a Guardian reader, so he's the obvious one that leaps to mind. A whole bunch of critics are going to be super delighted when a seldom performed Chekhov play gets revived at a major institution. To them, that's like Christmas comes early.
Mm.
But to 95% of the population, there's nothing more tedious in the history of the world. So, you know, and as long as theatres are bound to operate in an ecology where they are arbiters of whether what they make is good or not, have those tastes. You know, maybe it's out of date of me to say this. Maybe all the other ones are dead now, aren't they?
What?
All the other old white theatre critics, don't
they? But it's difficult, isn't it? Because even as the old white, even as one generation dies off, because we've created a value structure based on those values, we're still teaching that.
But I think that's, you know, that is interesting for us because our audience is something like, is it 67% under 30? Something around that. It's a really young audience. Mm. It's a really young audience. And so actually, and you know, our artists are really young as well. I mean, I often feel like I'm the oldest person in this building and I'm 32. But you are actually. But you know, it's really, really young artists and it's really, really young audiences often, not exclusively. And actually, so that's why I have this feeling like the kind of decisions we make about like what voices we kind of privilege and what kind of stories make it onto our stage is going to, you know, define what the tastes are to some extent in the future.
Yeah, I just think in theatre everything the default should be it's new. Everything should be new. Because at the moment the default is everything's a revival of a classic, you know. And like if you know, in the Guardian, you know, autumn previews or whatever, the 10 most exciting theatre events of the upcoming season, 8 or 9 of them will be so-and-so's doing his Hamlet, can't wait to see it. So-and-so's doing his fucking Cherry Orchard. That should be the exception. Occasionally we should revive an old play.
I mean, it's
everything
the equivalent of Friends reruns, right?
Yeah.
And
like,
also, if you're
like...
And
the biggest events in publishing this year are not someone's reprinted Bleak House. Everything should be new. I had a meeting with an artist this morning who did a show in our Feminism Festival last week, a one-woman Macbeth. It was ace. It was really good, and I'm talking to her about bringing it back next year. But one of the suggestions, I didn't make this suggestion to her, so if you're listening, Hayley, I should have said this to her. You know, one of my suggestions was, I was tempted to say, was change the title. Because Macbeth is off-putting to our audience.
Yeah.
You know, the rest of the theatre wants to go and see Macbeth, maybe at the National or whatever. I don't want anything in our programme that's called Macbeth.
Yeah.
It makes us look less regressive. Change the title. Give it a funky, sexy
and
title.
Like, kudos to you, because if I'd got that email way back when, I'd be like, oh, and probably not read it.
Yeah, exactly. It's a off, you know, even though it's a great show, it's... by our standards, not an exciting prospect.
And why, if you've got like, if you've got some massive celebrity like who's up for like doing a play at your theatre, like wouldn't you do like a more interesting play than Hamlet? You're going to sell the tickets anyway, so like, I don't know, do something a bit more exciting. If you've got Benedict Cumberbatch, for example, like.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I speak aside. Goodness knows, I'm sure all of us in this room love Shakespeare. Nothing wrong with Shakespeare. It's great, but it's fine. I'm perfectly happy if there's only one revival of Hamlet in the next 10 years. I can read it, it's still there, it's on, if you watch a film, I don't have to see 18 revivals every fucking year.
I'm going to allow each, I reckon I'm going to allow each of like the big flagships one Shakespeare a year.
Yes.
For their fucking school's money, right? Because that money is useful to them, I suppose, and it stops them like sucking up more public resources. So they can have one, and they all have to do different ones.
Yeah, and fight it out between themselves. Yeah, I like that. Or maybe it's like a rota system. They're allowed like Hamlet every 25 years.
Because it's the September. Because you have like your Christmas show, right, for your money, and then you have your September Shakespeare classical on the syllabus thing. They're allowed that, and then everything else. Or they can trade it out for like a Chekhov or an Ibsen if they must.
Yeah.
Anyway. right, last question.
Just solved.
Solved. There we go.
So your pitch for a. Chief Exec of the Arts Council right there.
No. Oh, God. Can you imagine a worse job? Right, last question. When you go from this place being Camden People's Theatre, part A, and part B being the plane of human existence, what do you want to leave behind?
Well, I've already told you that when people ask me to look in the future, I come out in hives. So now you've asked me to contemplate my own death.
Oh, come on. Theatre's all about contemplating our own death. That's all I do.
One of the best shows in the history of theatre is Improbable's Life Game.
Mm.
And the final scene in which they like interview someone about their life and act out the scenes of their life that they get told. And the last scene is always, you know, how would you like to die? And then the improbable performers act out their death in front of the person who's getting interviewed. It's always like heart in the mouth stuff, which is pretty much how I feel now that I've got to go. Legacies, what do you want to leave behind?
I've got this like feeling like I kind of like almost want to, I mean there's obviously things we want to change, but I also kind of want to leave CPT largely how we found it, and like that's why I've got, you know, this sort of like there's gonna probably become a point where my ambitions move on from what CPT is here to do, and rather than us kind of trying to change CPT to fit our ambition, that actually that's the point for us to move on.
Mm-hmm.
And like, so I just kind of really like to get CPT being like a risk-taking central London theatre as well as we possibly can, and then move on, really. I mean, it is a big thing for me about like the diversity of who makes work and who comes into the building, and like as far as we can push that and make it as mixed as we possibly can, and as kind of reflective of who lives in this local area as we possibly can, the better. That's a big thing. But I think it's just, yeah, getting it working, doing what it's meant to do really well, and then move on to the next challenge. Don't try and like hugely change what it does, because it's important, you know?
I feel like that's really important. I feel like that's worth saying again, because so many organisations do this thing where they have something brilliant and alive, and the ambition of the people within it forces that organisation to change. And they do stupid things like build a new building that totally changes the character of what the place is, or move, or you know, whatever, or start trying to pull in bigger in inverted commas artists or more commercial stuff and sell more tickets, and that ambition totally changes what the place is.
Yeah.
And the thing that it was what was alive and special.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, I'm quite resistant to this idea about you know, directors like coming in and having like a big vision for how they're going to totally transform a place, because actually Well, I mean, of course there's there's things that do need to, you know, to change. But I think, you know, CPT has a very specific role to play in the London ecology, and it's a really, you know, and the national ecology, and I think it's a really, really important role to play. And I think our job is to, yes, refine it, yes, get it doing it better, but not in any way to kind of like fundamentally change the core of what it is.
So there's CPT.
So my ambition is not to have an ambition. There you go. That's
yeah. We wanted to be like we wanted to leave a little oasis. I mean, it's important that it's a central London place too. We wanted to be like a little oasis, a little better world, template for a better world in the middle of
Euston,
just off Euston Road.
Just off Euston.
And I mean, that's
the road to hell often.
I mean, that is. I mean, we do talk about this building a lot. I mean, it is awful in a lot of ways. But then also, like, I just think I just have this feeling like if we go. You know, it's not going to become another interesting alternative experimental arts venue, is it? It's going to become a Costa Coffee. And
yeah,
so,
it's more and more significant that little sleazy fly-by-night places like CBT survive in central London.
Yeah.
I'm more and more motivated about that than I was 5 years ago, given what's happening to London.
We try to be as sleazy and fly-by-night as we possibly can.
I feel like that's an excellent tagline.
Yeah.
Sleazy and fly-by-night. And do either of you want to tell me about what you want to leave when you're gone forever, or is that a question too much?
I haven't really thought about it. I'd like to write a really good book of nature writing. Really, I sort of think something about like just maybe otters, life on Exmoor, wildlife on Exmoor.
Okay.
But I'm being a bit tongue-in-cheek, but that is actually one thing I would like to. When I retire, though, maybe. I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. I'd like to be fondly remembered by my loved ones. That's about the apex of my ambition. Even that's looking quite hard to achieve, to be honest. I mean, it'd be nice to... Yeah, who knows? It'd be nice to leave, like, some theatre work that... Maybe I could be the... person whose plays are being boringly revived at the National Theatre in 100 years' time. yeah, it'd be nice to have a sense that one's work had left some kind of legacy, but exactly what that could be.
I mean, I really, like, I would, you know, to be a bit more, you know, serious, I would genuinely like to kind of play a significant role in kind of making... you know, a theatre sector that is more relevant and accessible to a much, much broader range of people. And I don't, you know, I think that it's realistic that I can contribute significantly to making that change.
Mm.
And I think that's quite a good... I don't think it's actually that hard. I think if we'd, like, really put our minds... I mean, it's a small enough sector, isn't it? Like, I think if we just all, like, put our minds to it and, like, work...
to actually do what we talk about all the time.
Yeah. And not, like, yeah, not, like, sit around, like, chin-stroking all the time, but just get on and do it, you know? And I think...
It's harder to do it in an era where the answer being undermined than it would be.
Well, with that kind of attitude, Brian, it is. No, I agree. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's political. I mean, we can't sort of, like, lay all the blame at our own doors, because we're kind of, like, just all desperately, like, trying to cling on and, like, scrap together enough money to survive. But,
No, I suppose I'm only saying that as a corrective to you saying it's not that hard, which I agree, in principle it isn't, but it's unnecessarily harder in an era when you're having to make the case for arts funding in the first place. But yes, no, I agree. I don't mean to be the council of despair. Let's all give up and throw our hands in the air.
I think I vacillate. Is that the word? Vacillate quite wildly between just wanting to add something to the sum of human knowledge. Just that.
Yeah.
Which again seems really simple, but then when you think about human knowledge, it's quite
on
Exmoor. But then also I sort of think maybe there's an honourableness in just passing into nothing. There's like a respectability to that, you know.
Oh yeah, and aren't we, you know, like you said earlier, isn't the theatre all about sort of coming to terms with our own transience? So maybe that's just demonstrates we're very good theatre people that we don't actually give a fuck about our legacy.
Yeah. It's a funny thing though, isn't it? Because on the one hand, theatre does feel like it just it's gone. It doesn't ever exist in a tangible form.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, like it feels so much of how we think about theatre is this big weighty thing, this cultural thing. I was at the Old Vic last night, like it felt like heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm watching the Nose Knife thing and thinking about all the other people that had been on that stage, and like, God, can you imagine, like, carrying that weight? If I was acting on that stage, I would feel them sitting on my shoulders.
Mm-mm.
This isn't a point. This is me rambling.
I mean, my theatre company started its life in the late 1990s at BAC under Tom, when Tom Morris ran BAC. And I know that a lot of other companies or artists, as ours do, look back on that as a sort of halcyon era. When the bar was upstairs, and it seemed to be like a febrile atmosphere of possibility and artistic invention. But probably, you know, I imagine most artists have got like an equivalent to what Tom Morris's BAC is to us, and Tom Kennedy and people like us and a bunch of other companies.
Might even be CPT for some.
Well, that's exactly what I was about to say.
Oh, sorry.
That comes to mind as maybe something that would be nice to think of as a legacy, in that in 20 years' time, a bunch of artists who are here now look back and think, oh, that was a thing, wasn't it? We were part of the movement, or there was a moment. It was an exciting time to be there, and that atmosphere helped us create good work or hoard some precious memories.
Because I guess you kind of don't know, because you don't know what pebble you're dropping into people's heads now, into artists, that in however many years will be a ripple that is a thing that will be a pebble that's a bigger ripple, you know. I've over exhausted that metaphor.
But I think also, like, just that it, you know, it's quite fun to be here, and it does feel quite fun to me quite a lot of the time, and I hope that the artists feel like it's quite a fun, you know, and audiences as well feel like it's quite a cool, fun place to be. I think that's good, you know, that people have a good time.
I feel like that's a really good place to start. do either of you want to add anything to this? Are there things you're like, I should have said that?
Probably come to me at 3 a.m.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to let Amber have the last word. Say that I've just ruined it by interposing this.
We'll just cut that off. That's fine. That's it. Okay, thank you so much, guys.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real, frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.